The Digger's Song, was written in 1649 by Gerard Winstanley, leader of the Diggers. The Diggers, unable and unwilling to pay exorbitant rents to rich landlords, took over wasteland and began to build their own community. Time after time, they were attacked by local soldiers under orders from the priests and lords. Their growing crops were pulled up and discarded. The Diggers, staunch pacifists, were repeatedly beaten up, but offered no physical resistance. Moving from place to place and encouraging others to follow their example, they struggled on for 2 years, preaching a vision of common ownership of the land and shared labor. What happened to the Diggers should have taught us two things. First, by nature of their example, that common and equal work, without lords or masters, can be a practical alternative to the robbery and inequality of capitalism. Second, that a willingness to accept the violence and destruction of the state without fighting back is, in the end, self-destructive. St. George's Hill, the most famous of the Diggers' plots of squatted land, is now a highly select residential area full of well-to-do stockbrokers.
You noble diggers all, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers all, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name. Your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now. Your houses they pull down to fright your men in town. But the gentry must come down and the poor shall wear the crown. Stand up now, diggers all. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, stand up now. The gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found. Their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise. The devil in them lies, and hath blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. Against lawyers and against priests, stand up now, stand up now. Against lawyers and against priests, stand up now. For tyrants they are both, even flat against their oath. To grant us they are loath, free meat and drink and cloth. Stand up now, diggers all. The club is all their law, stand up now, stand up now. The club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe. But they no vision saw, to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all.
1649, St. George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole, so it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the lands. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroying their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.
We'll conclude the program as I read from the final chapter of The Ascent of Humanity, the age of separation, the age of reunion, and the convergence of crises that's birthing the transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. Some of the things in the final part of the book I have some trouble with, namely the question of purpose in the universe. That concept is hard for me to divorce from the scriptural notion that an external deity placed humans on the earth with some goal in mind. To me, the atrocities of the age of separation are proof that the universe has no purpose, for if it did, it could only be an evil one. It's fine with me to live in a universe with no purpose. I don't need the universe to have a purpose because I have one, which is the co-creation of beauty and ending the cruelty and ugliness of domination and control. We continue with Charles Eisenstein. The Gaian Birthing. The mounting destruction, suffering, and catastrophes of the last millennia, and especially the last few centuries, are the birthing pains of the human race, being born into a new form of relationship to the universe. The question is, if we are being born, who is doing the birthing? The intuitive answer is Mother Earth, of course, Mother Earth or even Mother Universe. No matter that the birth pangs are manifestly of human origin, they are inescapable as accompaniments to separation, which is itself inescapably woven into the fabric of biology. Separation was not a watershed event, a discrete wrong turn as implied in the Eden story, but a cumulative process that started in pre-human times, even pre-biotic times. Nature, the universe, and even mathematical systems tend toward increasingly complex order and, more significantly, organization, which implies a differentiation of roles, an off-budding of the semi-autonomous individuals that we know as life forms. In other words, the present convergence of crises is of transhuman origin, perhaps even an evolutionary inevitability. It's the crescendo of complexity, from bacteria to nucleated cell, to multicellular organism, to the human brain, to the tribe, to the agricultural civilization, to the industrial economy, to the noosphere, just a matter of one lucky chance after another? I have explained how a negative answer to this question need not imply divine guidance by an external creator God, not if order and organization is inherent in reality, not if purpose is inherent in the universe. But let's put it more poetically. Let us explore instead the idea that the universe, and in particular the Earth, was pregnant with life, with intelligence, with civilization, with the entire course of separation and reunion from the very beginning. Does anyone else find it odd that the raw materials for technology are so readily available, that metals are so abundant near the Earth's surface, that domesticable animals and plants suitable for agriculture were so accessible, that the Earth laid down enormous fossil fuel deposits capable of powering an industrial revolution? What about the fact that many genes expressed only in higher animals were present in the genome hundreds of millions of years before they were ever needed, as if waiting for the time to exercise their function? If we didn't know better, we might think the collection of the Earth's organic and inorganic processes that we know as Gaia were consciously executing a plan to bring a technological species into being. In Chapter 6, I speculated that life on Earth is of dual parentage, Earth and sky, that the primordial planet was a fertile womb seeded by genetic material from space. Some people think that this material encodes a program for the eventual rise of technological civilization, a carboniferous age to lay down oil and coal deposits, intelligent life forms to utilize them. Because the mentality of manipulation and control, the distancing from nature, is an inseparable aspect of our rise as a technological species, we could also say that the present extreme of separation is part of that same program. To what end? Perhaps technology will culminate in some form of space travel, by which we will propagate biological material further throughout the universe and accomplish Gaia's reproduction. Gaia, we might say, is going to seed, devoting every last resource to its production and dispersal. One of the chief criticisms of Gaia theory is that natural selection cannot operate on a planet as a whole, for it has no competitors. But maybe that is untrue. Maybe planets, or biospheres to be more precise, reproduce and compete as well, but on a far grander scale and time frame. What happens after a plant goes to seed? If it is an annual, it dies. If it is a perennial, it goes into a period of hibernation or rest. Is our present despoilation of planet Earth a mechanism for the marshaling of every resource toward reproduction? Is it the poisoning of our womb that will motivate us to search for another? I think not. The birthing that we are undergoing is something far greater than the eventual replication of the same sad pattern in some other place and time. If our planet were to perish, whether or not we sent genetic material, living organisms, or even human colonies into space, I would consider that to be an aborted birth, a stillbirth. In the environmental movement, the peace movement, the holistic medical movement, and others in education, information technology, psychology, and so on, we have a picture of what humanity could become, the age of reunion I have described in this book. But the possibility of stillbirth is also quite real. Perhaps it has already happened before. Perhaps the myths of Atlantis and Babel harbor a kernel of historical truth. Perhaps there was a deluge followed by a new beginning. Sometimes I wonder, what would we do if a total collapse were imminent? Knowing that every written record, maybe every physical record of our civilization would perish, how would we transmit what we have learned to the future? The only way would be to embed it in its myths, sacred stories encoding important information to guide us in a future age. It is in part this possibility that has impelled me toward the study of myth. Maybe therein is encoded wisdom that can avert us from being stillborn again. More likely is that the old myths and legends, Atlantis, the flood, and so on, embody psychological and not historical truths. Atlantis, for example, represents a submerged higher potential, once glimpsed, now lost, still possible in our personal and collective futures. The myth makers of old, tapping into a great wisdom, foresaw the inevitable tragic denouement of humanity's ascent to separation, and foresaw as well the possibility of something greater being born from its ashes. This is the kingdom of God following Armageddon, the renewal of heaven and earth following Ragnarok. The progression of social and ecological disintegration was written into the future long, long ago, at the very dawn of the separation, which took a series of quantum leaps with stone and fire technology, and again with agriculture, and again with modern science and technology. While the catastrophic effects of separation are flagrantly apparent to many people today, it was not so obvious in the past, when vast amounts of social, natural, cultural, and spiritual capital were yet to be depleted, that disaster was in the works. Who could have guessed, when the first granary was built in prehistoric Mesopotamia, and the first forest cut down in Sumer, where it would all lead? Nonetheless, there have always been visionaries who have seen where our separation from self, nature, and other would inevitably lead. Centuries ago, millennia ago, they pointed us urgently in the other direction, even as they recognized the inevitability of the still ripening catastrophe. All of them did their best to leave us messages, clues, and hints that a different way is possible, not so much to stem the tide of history, but to teach us how to proceed after the crash of our unsustainable story of self. Their messages are about transcendence, transcending the limited, limiting, and dilatory separate self of our present science, religion, economics, medicine, and psychology. They spoke their messages in different ways, by whatever means were expedient to transmit them through the ages. Some of them, such as Jesus of Nazareth, were unfortunate enough to have had a religion founded around them that twisted their teachings toward ends diametrically opposed to their original intent. Yet even so, the original meanings often lay encoded in whatever words of theirs have been preserved. Far more of these teachers quickly became anonymous. We will never know their names, but their messages survive in many forms. Some communicated with the future by creating myths and legends, poems and songs, dances and rituals for receptive people to decode, or more often, that plant a seed in the unconscious mind of the listener or performer. Even if no one can explain the logic behind such rituals, everyone who performs them is changed, quickened, implanted with a knowledge that is only much later, when the time is right, followed by understanding. Still others communicated with the future through direct personal transmission to disciples. Seeing the hopelessness of stemming the virus of separation until it had consumed all, perhaps seeing also the imminent demise of their own cultures at the hands of encroaching agriculturalists, they founded lineages and hid them within the destroyer civilizations themselves. Perhaps this process started in Neanderthal times, as hinted at by the Yurok story of the Woge in Chapter 2. Knowledge was passed down personally through generation after generation of Zen masters, Sufis, shamans, Christian mystics, Kabbalists, Taoists, yogis, wizards, and other individuals, kept disguised within folk religion or completely hidden until times were ripe for its blossoming. That time is today, and it is no coincidence that many of these formerly secret traditions are making their knowledge public as best they can. Science fiction writers have envisioned humankind's next evolutionary step as a collective transition to a higher level of organization. Just as a termite mound has an individuality and sentience that transcends each individual termite, just as the brain's intelligence emerges out of the coordinated activity of billions of neurons, so also might a racial intelligence emerge from the tighter and faster linkage of individual human minds. Werner Vinge has described a future in which people augment their mental capacities and memory with computer add-ons, which make mental processes more accessible from person to person, resulting in an uber mind. Just as an organism emerges out of the coordinated activity of billions of cells, so might a new kind of metahuman entity arise out of the coordinated activity of billions of humans, especially when communication among them happens as fast as hormonal or bioelectric communication in the body. We might see Gaia then as birthing a collective human entity whose embryonic organs began differentiating with the specialization of labor in the first builder societies and whose information processing capabilities are finally reaching the speed of thought in the internet age. Werner Vinge and similar thinkers are firmly encamped in the gee whiz, the future ideology of technological progress. However, their techno-wonderama scenarios arise ultimately from a valid intuition of transcendence in our not-too-distant future. Their mistake lies in assuming that this collective transcendence can happen without a simultaneous and corresponding transcendence on the individual level. What organism could survive whose cells believe themselves to be in constant competition with each other and at war with the environment, the body, in a struggle for resources without any purpose or significance to life beyond their own replication? That is a pretty good description of cancer cells. No, in a healthy organism, the cells seek the perfection and fulfillment of their role. Is this not identical to what I have advocated for us humans? Individually, in the spirit of the gift and the fusion of work and art, collectively, in the use of science to better understand and technology to better fulfill our role and function in nature. It is a role and function that evolves as nature moves toward higher degrees of complexity and organization. So it is not passive or static, yet it is humble, seeking to participate rather than subjugate, to appreciate rather than to control. The organismic model of human society has oft been a justification for fascism, an elevation of the corporate body over the rights, needs, and welfare of the individual. The fascistic interpretation, however, is itself a product of deeper mechanistic assumptions about biology and society. For in fact, the specialized cells of a body bear little similarity to the specialized workers in a hierarchical factory system. Recent advances in genetics and neurology, which I touched on in Chapter 6, have forever debunked the top-down control model of morphology. There is no central authority that dictates the development and function of each cell. Of course, each cell responds to signals from the environment, but the environment's intelligence is an emergent property, not centralized in a commanding authority, nor programmed into a collection of genes. Moreover, each cell type responds to the sea of hormones, electrical fields, and other communication media in a unique way. Even within a given cell type, individual cells respond uniquely according to their location and other unknown factors. Certainly, none of them seek to hoard resources for themselves. Like hunter-gatherers who do not store food, they trust in the ongoing supply of life-sustaining sugar and oxygen. nor do sales maximize their, quote, self-interest at the expense of the rest, not unless they are cancer cells. That is why we humans have been compared, in Agent Smith's words, to a cancer on this planet. But the imperative of endless growth, like the campaign to maximize me and mine, and like the program to control the world, is founded on an illusion, the discrete and separate self. Now that this illusion is crumbling, now that its scientific foundations are falling apart and its practical consequence destroying us, a possibility is arising for a new kind of society, as well coordinated as a healthy multicellular organism, and as individually creative, fulfilling, and purposeful as the life of a hunter-gatherer. Our collective transcendence of all we have been is thus founded on an individual transcendence of what we thought we were. And in a beautiful and necessary synchronicity, it is the same convergence of crises that will bring about both. The individual transcendence I speak of is the spiritual awakening that so often happens in the wake of major life tragedies and transitions, when life falls apart. The sudden life event is merely the quickening of a long gestating process. The potential for transcendence lies latent in all of us, but in our society is rarely allowed to blossom forth. In fact, it is arrested almost purposefully by the structures of education, religion, and the, quote, struggle to survive that defines modern adulthood. The arrest of this developmental stage bears striking similarities to that of humanity collectively. Joseph Chilton Pierce describes the natural progression of human development in his books Revolution's End and The Biology of Transcendence. The growing child goes through several developmental stages, concrete operations, formal operations, and so on, each corresponding to a phase of brain development. Up through early adolescence, each of a child's several brains, the reptilian forebrain, the limbic system, and the cerebral cortex develops in turn, culminating in the development of rational, analytical thought in the early teen years, which we take as the highest form of cognition. But Pierce argues compellingly that there is supposed to be another phase of brain organization in the middle to late teens associated with the prefrontal cortex, whose function is largely a mystery to conventional science, and the neurological dimension of the heart, which conventional science ignores altogether. He associates these developments with intuitive, holistic, transpersonal cognitive functions that our society devalues or invalidates entirely. Indeed, how could we validate them, given that they conflict with fundamental tenets of self and world? Like much learning, adolescents properly develop these functions through modeling, but the models are few indeed. How can someone develop an ability that the ambient ideology says does not exist, and for which there is no model? Simply put, at about the age of 15, human beings are meant to develop empathetic, holistic, transpersonal modes of cognition, abilities that violate the dogma of the discrete and separate self. Primitive societies acknowledged these abilities and fostered their development, providing both models and methods for transcendence of the limited rational ego self of the pre-teen. This was the point of many coming-of-age ceremonies, in which the teenager's ego boundaries were temporarily shattered through means such as psychotropic plants, deprivation of food, water, or sleep, isolation from the tribe, pain, or other intense ritual experiences. Returning to the tribe afterward, the young man or woman, no longer a child, would have a profoundly different conception of self. Not by accident, many of these ceremonies incorporate ritual reenactments of the birth process. The rational, analytical, objective worldview implicit in the discrete Cartesian self separate and distinct from all other cells in their environment, is a necessary and proper phase of human development. It is a phase, however, that sets the stage for a further phase, one that we typically no longer experience. We remain, therefore, stuck in a perpetual adolescence, waiting our whole lives for some momentous happening that never happens. Joseph Chilton Pierce put it eloquently, quote, "What it is that is supposed to happen at this age remains a mystery. For though it may linger like Thomas Wolfe's grape bursting in the throat, it never happens." George Leonard spoke of an anguished longing so acute he knew it could never be assuaged. A university student said that since 14, she had waited for a momentous happening that didn't happen. Were the issue sexual, it would not be an unknown. A student wrote his parents that he loved his third year of college, but had awakened one night with a cold hand of terror clutching his heart. Since about 14, he reported, he felt that something tremendous was supposed to happen. Now, approaching 21, he had been waiting for 7 years, and it hadn't happened. Suppose, he asked himself, that late night awakening, it never happens, and I never even know what was supposed to have been, close quote, a possibility that struck him with despair. When I read this to my brother John, he replied, "Yeah." And then one day you think, hey, I'm 28 now, I guess it must have happened. And so we live with an emptiness inside, a dissatisfaction stemming from the inner knowledge that there is supposed to be more. No accident is it that the features of the pre-transcendent adolescent correspond precisely to the worldview of the Newtonian world machine founded on our self-conception as separate subjects. That our development remains arrested in the analytic ego phase is necessary for the continuation of society as we know it, for the perpetuation of the world under control. A happy corollary, though, is that the ending of this world of property, alienation, and control will coincide with the ending of all the social and ideological conditions that arrest our transcendence. Already it is happening. As the technologies of reunion build momentum. Even if you are no longer an adolescent, it is not too late. There are more and more models for transcendence now, and our capabilities lie dormant, deeply buried but never dead. All it takes is the equivalent of the coming-of-age ceremony, which is the crumbling of the pre-adolescent world of the discrete and separate self. In the absence of wise elders to supplement such a ceremony, the world will do it for us, simply because that pre-adolescent ego world is not sustainable. Like our own society, based on the same principles, it inevitably generates converging crises that eventually reveal its fraudulence. The same dynamic applies to the collective development of the human species. We are poised at the edge of transcendence. Having fully developed to the utmost extreme the world of the rational ego self, we have fulfilled that stage in which we are meant to consummate our individuation as separate beings, or in the collective case, as an identity man, separate and distinct from nature. While we may lament the vast suffering that separation has rendered, another way to look at it is that we are growing up. This process of individuation is necessary to discover who we really are collectively as a species. Throughout childhood and into adolescence, our job is to individuate and grow. We take from our mother as much as we need, as much as she can give, with gratitude, perhaps, but also with a natural, easy selfishness. As a species, this is what we have done to Mother Earth. We have treated her treasures as ours to take, with the same sense of entitlement with which a child demands food from mother. And as we have done, so we have developed as a species an independent identity no longer derived from Mother Earth, from her places, plants, and animals, in some sense, we have been weaned. In normal development, the adolescent enters true adulthood and no longer takes selfishly from his mother. To be sure, in our society, with its lack of coming-of-age rituals, we often see adolescence extended for years and decades into what would otherwise be adulthood. How do you behave when you go home to visit your parents? This is an abnormal state of affairs. By our late teens or early 20s, we should have become independent of our biological parents and then desirous of supporting them, releasing the sense of entitlement proper to childhood. It is time to turn around. It is time to turn around and begin to cherish and protect the mother that has given unto near collapse that we might grow. A mother by nature will continue to give and give even past her capacity, as the earth is doing now. What then is the coming of age ritual for the human race? What is to initiate us into adulthood? Coming of age rituals varied across cultures, but they had in common a goal of transcending the childhood sense of self, the individuated ego, separate, objective, rational, maximizing its own aggrandizement, feeding and growing, the very precepts of modern economics. These lower chakra, limbic, and cerebral cortex functions are not to be abandoned, but integrated into a higher order of being capable of fulfilling a function in a larger connected whole, the clan, the tribe, the village, the forest. For this to happen, a child's self-definition must be temporarily shattered or released. The adolescent is therefore put in a situation unprecedented in his experience, to which the old self-conceptions and world conceptions no longer apply. And now the coming-of-age ceremony for the human race has commenced. Indeed, it has been building for millennia in the vast historical sweep of violence and suffering that has accompanied the ascent of humanity, our separation, our program of control. It is not localizable in space or time, but visits each people, each nation, each individual in a unique way. In the present age, though, a critical mass is building in which the world will crumble for many people all at once, in the space of a few years or decades. Then, the innate spiritual transcendence that is each individual's birthright will once again become the rule, not the exception. Then the age of reunion will have commenced. Then we will look upon one another and upon the animals and the trees and the planet and see not competitors or resources or others, but extensions of ourselves. We will experience a world that is wholly sacred, pregnant with creativity, immanent with purpose, alive with spirit, in love with life, in love with the world. We will humbly join in the ongoing co-creation of beauty, as we are already, but soon it will be with conscious awareness, our individuation complete. We will unite with nature in full-fledged partnership. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Eulogy and Redemption. What then of the victims? What shall we say to the men, women, and children whose ruined lives have followed in the wake of our ascent? Should we not lament the billions of passenger pigeons whose flocks once darkened the skies? Should we not mourn the dodo, the great auk, the American chestnut, and the millions more now following them to extinction? What of the elder bushes, a century old, keystone species of a fantastic ecology, torn up and paved over to build a new road? What of the forests turned to deserts, the native children shot for sport by white settlers, the women tortured and burned alive as witches for practicing herbal medicine, the school children today cajoled, coerced, and medicated into spending the kingdom of childhood behind a desk in a room, standing in line? The coal miners of the 19th century, emerging decades later, stunted, broken, and destitute from the mines. The babies deprived of the breast. The women raped, the men tortured and killed, the children watching the soldiers who did it. What can we say of the concentration camps, Auschwitz, the Gulag, the unspeakable hardship of the men sentenced to a lingering death at hard labor? What shall we say to the victims of communist purges and to the families sent a bill for the executioner's bullet? What of the black man beaten and lynched and a picture postcard of the event sent to his mother? What shall we say to the starving children past the point of hunger, bodies falling apart? And what shall we say to their mothers? And what of the children working in toy factories, rug factories, chocolate plantations? The countless assembly line workers, their human creativity reduced to a few rote movements, producing empty consumer junk out of toxic materials, destined sooner rather than later for the landfill. The betrayal after betrayal of the Native Americans, people massacred, lands cheated, religion outlawed, culture purposefully destroyed. The cancer victims of a poisoned world, the slaves long ago who labored on the pyramids. Contrast a life carrying stone to the life of a hunter-gatherer, and the bargain we have made becomes clear. In this, the first monument to the machine, the folly and the horror of our ascent is clear. An exchange of life for labor to erect a useless edifice. No authentic peace with the world can be achieved in ignorance of the facts. Read books like A Language Older Than Words, Night, Gulag Archipelago, The Dying of the Trees, The Lost Language of Plants, Evolution's End, Trail of Tears, Rebels Against the Future. We must be utterly clear about what our civilization has wrought. If we, like the technological utopians of the Industrial Revolution, justifying the mines and mills, maintain that the sacrifices of the victims are a necessary and worthwhile price to pay for our ascent to a higher state, then we must be clear on what that price has been. The price of separation has been no other, and could be no other, than the furthest possible extreme of evil. That the reunion I have spoken of, the rebirth at a higher level of consciousness, could only come through resolving and integrating our age-old course of separation is not a justification of its evil, no more than a criminal's remorse or a victim's forgiveness justifies the crime. Nonetheless, there is another way to understand the suffering of separation's victims. Some years ago, a man I know very well was obliged to dig up a splendid burdock plant that grew outside his home. He had been asked to dig it up before, and in a semblance of compliance had half-heartedly sheared off the leaves, leaving the root intact. This time, his wife supervised him to ensure that he did it right, that he dug it up, root and all. Every moment his heart was heavy, but his fear of his wife's anger was enough to overcome his reluctance and prevent him from standing up for his integrity. Something changed that day. In his words, quote, "Our marriage has survived many onslaughts because it had a strong, deep root, and now that is gone," close quote. The plant had kept coming back. It wanted to grow there, but the man imposed his will, which was not even truly his own, onto nature. He got nature under control. The fate of that burdock plant, the process by which it was destroyed, is really no different in essence from the worst extremes of ecocide and genocide. In both, there is a perceived necessity, a fear that overcomes our goodness, and a destruction of the innocent. But later, after the marriage went through a tumultuous period, he realized that the burdock had given him an important teaching that only its self-sacrifice could have delivered. It was a teaching about boundaries, integrity, communication, and change, and he had a clear sense that the plant chose to grow there precisely for that teaching. Donna Gates, the woman who developed the body ecology protocol for curing autism, once told me that she has noticed a similarity among autistic children's households. Beyond the proximate factors of vaccines, mercury, antibiotics, and other body ecology disruptions lies a deeper reason for autism, a purpose, not a cause. She believes that these children have in some sense chosen to be born into their circumstances as a way to bring a great gift to their parents and families. Of course, few parents see autism as a gift. Having an autistic child is like having a permanent infant who requires intense care and never grows up. In many cases, normal life becomes impossible as the demands of the child consume all leisure time. Life ambitions give way to the demands of caring for another being without thought of recompense. Reread that last sentence. Isn't that precisely the prescription for joy that the saints have given us through the ages? Perhaps these children are noble spirits choosing their incarnation as a way to help us understand what is important in life. Donna has observed that autism strikes disproportionately in households where life was otherwise smooth sailing, in which the vacuity of modern goals and priorities would otherwise never have become apparent, at least not until time and youth were exhausted. Many autistic and otherwise, quote, mentally retarded children possess an undeniable spiritual quality about them. The description special is not merely a euphemism. When they are healed of autism, this quality remains. They are often remarkably selfless, content, compassionate, affectionate, and emotionally mature. In one sense, yes, they are the innocent victims of modern birthing practices, medical practices, pollution, and dietary ignorance. But from a higher perspective, they fulfill a noble purpose in our society's healing. We often think of misfortune as some kind of punishment for past evil, a theme which runs through religious thought both East and West. In the East, it is the idea that present suffering represents the negative karma generated through past misdeeds. In the West, we have the image of Yahweh striking down the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins, threatening Nineveh for its wickedness. However, the self-evident fact is that it is often the innocent who suffer the most demands of all kinds of theological contortions. From past lives to original sin, from future rebirth to heaven and hell, how else to explain the sweet, innocent babies in the children's cancer wards? If we are not to resort to blind, pitiless, purposeless chance, we need another explanation for the innocence of our victims. Perhaps they are great souls meeting the huge necessity for innocent victims that our civilization has wrought. I will go, they say. I am big enough. I am ready for this experience. We might look on whole peoples, cultures, or even species in the same way. While we might understand the decay of our civilization as a just desert for the violence it has perpetrated, how can we explain the destruction of the beautiful indigenous cultures of North America or any continent you care to choose? What sin against God, man, or nature could justify their violent extinction? True, some were supposedly warlike and unfriendly to outsiders, but many amazed their first European contacts with their childlike trust and easy generosity. None of them, not even the most warlike, perpetrated anything comparable to the human and environmental ruin that are the handiwork of machine civilizations. We might just as well try to explain how three-year-olds dying of cancer actually deserved it. No, if we are to believe in a purposeful universe, we must look elsewhere for an answer. The answer I offer you is that all of the people, culture, species, and ecosystems that we have destroyed constitute together a medicine for the great disease of our civilization, the disease named separation. It is the nature of the disease to destroy what is beautiful, to convert reality into a data set and life into money, with all the violence that such reduction of life implies. In the process of separation and eventual reunion at a higher level, selfless beings who already live in non-separation are structurally necessary. They, like the burdock root, like the autistic children, have taken on a noble and magnanimous role. The cultures, species, and people we have extirpated have delivered to us a teaching and a medicine. The cultures we have destroyed have not vanished without a trace. Anything we destroy leaves its imprint on our own spirit, whether on a personal or cultural level, automatically becoming a future medicine when it emerges into conscious experience. Please do not misunderstand. I do not mean to exculpate the victimizers because, after all, the victims volunteered for it, nor do I mean to depreciate the magnitude of the crime or the tragedy. Nonetheless, their sacrifice was not in vain. Because all acts of violence leave their imprint in the perpetrator, the perpetrators ultimately will suffer violence equal to that they have inflicted. Perhaps that is why Jesus, facing his tormentors, said, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." He understood what they were in for, the oceans of remorse they would need to traverse before arriving at peace. Etymologically, remorse means to bite back. Jesus saw that what they did to him, they were doing to themselves. Studies of soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder find that the most seriously disturbed are not those who have witnessed or suffered violence, but those who committed it. Soldiers who were in low-intensity battles but had killed someone suffered a higher rate of PTSD than soldiers who experienced high-intensity battles but did not kill anyone. As researcher Rachel McNair puts it, "Despite all the killing we've done, the human mind is not designed to kill. Portions of us get sick when we kill. Killing is against our nature." Enormous forces must be applied to render a human being into a killer, someone who could cut down forests, tear up land, or kill innocent people. To do the things we do requires that we be removed from our natural-born state of wholeness, enchantment, connectedness, and biophilia. To commit the heinous violence of our culture, even in its muted, indirect forms such as consumerism, we must first be mangled ourselves. We perpetrators are the end products of a spirit-wrecking machine thousands of years in the making that has battered and wounded us almost beyond recognition. Our healing happens through our victims, just as my friend's healing required that he destroy and mourn the burdock plant. Our separation, our ruined wholeness, our fallen state leads inevitably to acts of violence. Violence is a symptom of a wounded spirit, and the medicine for this disease is precisely the consequence of that violence. The process of acknowledging and mourning what we have done is itself healing. To simply withhold opportunities for violence from a wounded person is not a sustainable solution. Something has to bring it to the surface, and something eventually will. Does this mean that I can excuse myself from all the hurt I've caused in my life, thinking, "Well, my wound drove me to it, and I need to do that to recover"? No. The healing comes only through the realization, "My God, what have I done?" It is the remorse that is healing. On a cultural level, then, it is healing for us to face up to the crimes of our civilization, the dirty secrets of our past. Living in denial of the bitter facts only perpetuates more violence and prolongs our state of separation and suffering. The truth is coming to light now as we acknowledge what we have done to our planet, its cultures, and people. This is another sign that the age of reunion is nigh. Yes, many segments of our society are still in denial, choosing to live with the imprints of the wounds they have inflicted upon the world, not knowing that world and self, I and thou, are not really separate, and that no amount of control can keep the consequences eventually seeking out the perpetrator. The denial cannot last forever. The continuing pain of the festering wounds, which cannot be hidden forever, will eventually make the truth impossible to ignore or deny. Once upon a time, the Great Spirit spoke to the world. The Great Spirit said, "The world is sick. Millions of people have separated themselves off from life, and their suffering grows with each passing year. Soon, they will utterly destroy themselves and all that is good. They need medicine, but I warn you, most of the medicine they take, they will destroy most horribly. Who is ready to be the medicine?" And the spirits of the tribe said, "We are ready." And the spirits of the forest said, "We are ready." The spirits of the frogs said, "We are ready." The earth herself said, "I am ready." Martin Prechtel once said, "The redwoods are perfectly happy to go extinct." I know another man who described a long conversation he had with redwoods under the influence of LSD. The redwoods told him they were sad for the people chopping them down. They hoped that they would stop doing that before they destroyed themselves. The redwoods know the enormous, inescapable price to be paid for destroying such a magnificent being for the sake of mere money. All the life and beauty that has been destroyed, cut down, paved over, exterminated, raped, imprisoned, and enslaved has given the world a great gift. I sometimes ponder the Trail of Tears, so named not for the tears of the Cherokee, for there were none, but for the tears of the crowds of whites that gathered to watch them pass, dignified and unbroken. That image is burned indelibly onto the national psyche, and it will never let us rest until we have healed our own separation, softened the callousing of the soul that enabled us to commit such a crime. Nations and cultures, not just individuals, bear the self-inflicted wounds of their collective crimes. Karma is not just an individual phenomenon. National salvation will only come when we face up to the ugliness of our own past and feel the mirror image of the pain of every slave lashed, every man lynched, every child humiliated. One way or another, we must weep for all of this. The suffering of separation's victims is never in vain. From separation comes violence, which then reverberates in the soul of the perpetrator to form the seed of the separation's healing. I hope this is of some consolation to those of you who are among the victims, and that is all of us. We are all among the victims and the perpetrators both. I must break in here. I am sorry, Charles. It is not a consolation. I do not believe it. And were it in my power, I would turn back time and undo every instance of suffering. Continuing. Unusually, the eventual healing and redemption is invisible to us. Part of the suffering, in fact, is that it seems purposeless. The victims, too, experience a complete alienation, a loneliness intrinsic to all suffering. The image comes to mind of Christ on the cross. "Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" In this archetypal story, the Redeemer experiences the same extreme of separation from God, separation, that is, from all that we are and can be, that drove his tormentors. Do not think that the redwood, the burdock, the murdered and enslaved and ruined go without agony. Let us not underestimate the suffering of this world. Each of them partakes in Christ, making the ultimate sacrifice so that we might become whole. And you, dear reader, are no exception. Love and appreciate yourself as a noble being, born into this veil of tears for a sacred purpose. None of your hurts were in vain. One way or another, we must weep for all this. What goes for the crimes of humanity, nations, and cultures goes as well for us individually. Even as we appreciate our nobility and tend gently to our wounds, so also must we lament the violence, the scarring, the ruin of the other that has sprung from our separation, if ever we are able to become whole. The bodhisattva path, to remain in samsara until all beings are free, is more than a noble sacrifice. It is an organic necessity. The full integration of the pain from the life of separation is what impels us back toward wholeness. One way or another, the pain will be felt. We can either wait for it to come to us, like an addict determined to get a fix at any cost, or we can go to it. Perhaps if we can see the futility of control, the futility of perpetually postponing the consequences, then we will have the courage to face them. It is said that no addict truly enters recovery until he or she hits bottom. However, it is equally true that bottom is different from person to person. At some point, the addict decides no longer to evade the pain of a shattered life, wrecked family, sick body, or ruined career. He feels the accumulated agony, mourns what is lost, tries to make amends. Sometimes he succeeds in doing so before all is lost, before all friendship, all wealth, all health has been converted into money for the fix. Perhaps we humans will do so as well, and begin making amends to the world we are ruined before all beauty, all goodness, all wealth, all life is consumed. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition, published in 2006 by Charles Eisenstein. His website is ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download an MP3 of this program and all previous episodes at unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening.